Common Sense Conversations is a production of Taxpayers for Common Sense. Independent, nonpartisan, facts, and common sense since 1995.
Hi, welcome back to Common Sense Conversations. We took August off, so it's been a while. I'm Ryan Alexander, president of Taxpayers for Common Sense, or TCS for short. TCS is an independent budget watchdog, and we fight for the American taxpayer. We read bills, we make spreadsheets, we tell people what we've learned. So as we head into the fall and the end of the fiscal year, there's just lots to talk about. Joining me today, we have Steve Ellis, Executive Vice President.
Hello, folks.
Autumn Hanna, Vice President.
Hello, everyone.
And Wendy Jordan, Senior Policy Analyst for National Security.
Hi, everyone.
So Congress is back in town this week, and we're gearing up for, a busy month. I want to talk about just a few things that are happening now or will unfold in the next few weeks. I'm going to start with Autumn. You may have seen, listeners, a recent front page story in the New York Times that featured some of our most recent research on oil and gas development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Autumn, can you give people some background on kind of why taxpayers should care about this issue and some of the work Taxpayers has done over the years?
So we've been really looking at the drilling in the Arctic and this issue, which has been a hot issue for many years, one that we really didn't have much stake in the past. Just the idea of drilling in the Arctic isn't something that we oppose just on the merits of drilling. But we got involved when the provision was first discussed around the 2017 tax bill as a pay-for, a way to raise revenue to address the very expensive tax bill that was being debated. There were some estimates thrown around then that you'd get about $1 billion in revenue, which caught our attention when you're talking about a more than $1 trillion tax bill, so that we had a lot of problems with. Overall, the whole tax package and the debate, and we're weighing in on many of the pieces of that debate and so-called reform that we were shooting for. But in the energy and natural resource space, I started paying attention to this pay for and what was happening, and was this real money, and or is this a way to raise revenue? And when we looked at it, it just seemed like there were lots of red flags for taxpayers. I mean, we all know that the Arctic region of Alaska, pretty far away, hard to get to, hard to access. Throughout the years, we had sort of thought, well, maybe there's a lot of competition, there's evidence to show that you could raise a lot of money and that this is worth looking at. I think no matter what, we thought it was a joke that it was considered as a pay for the tax bill. But nonetheless, we started looking at the revenues and what's to be gained here for taxpayers. And we recently did an analysis.
I'm going to just jump in for a second. I mean, I want to just point out that, this isn't the first kind of phantom pay for related to natural resources extraction. We've worked in the past on, there was one several years ago about shale developments that at the time was not ready for commercial operation and still isn't, and it was used as a proposed for a pay for highway building, and there have been others over the years.
Well, and I would just add, the reason why it was included was not so much as technically or realistically, it was being used as a strategy to be able to get this over the goal line, and because it was less about paying for ridiculously this huge tax bill, but it was about taking advantage of budget reconciliation, which allowed them to move this forward as long as it had a budget implication with a simple majority in the Senate. It's not filibusterable. So this is something that Senator Murkowski, senior senator from Alaska, was able to jam through the Senate using this tactic.
Right. And I mean, that's the idea of using this as a pay for has been one that's been around for a long time. And usually when we're seeing something with oil and gas being used as a pay for, it's not really based in reality. And that's sort of what we started. That's definitely what we were seeing with the Arctic. And we started to crunch some of the numbers and look at this. And those of you who were listening back in July, I think it was when I discussed the New Mexico report we did, where we looked at a very high producing basin for oil and gas development. It makes a lot of money for taxpayers, and we talked about some of the leasing reforms to make sure we're getting a fair return there. And so, we're definitely, this was an issue. We're looking at the bigger picture of oil and gas development. These are resources taxpayers own, and are we getting what we're owed, and are we developing them in a way that's fiscally responsible and getting us money in the door? And so with the New York Times piece that our analysis there really looked at the provision from the tax bill, which allowed for two lease sales at a minimum of 800,000 acres. DOI is looking at the alternatives, a couple of scenarios there, and the one that offers the most acreage is just over 1.5 billion acres. And what we did was look at all the adjacent parcels to that area, and we had our researchers on staff just combed through all the leasing in the region. And what we found is that there was really not a lot of interest in the area, and historically parcels were not getting bid on, and there wasn't real revenue being generated. And we did an analysis of those adjacent parcels over the last 20 years and found that just about, if you use those numbers as a comparison, you would likely get about $20 million in revenue from drilling in 1.5 million acres. So
just to recap, projection, $1 billion. Looking at the math and reality, $20 million.
Big difference. We tried to be even more generous. We sliced it many different ways. Our full report on drilling in the Arctic and the revenues, that scenarios that we ran, it's all available on our website. But you know, we looked at even all of the bidding in the entire coastal region of Alaska, and for years and years. And if you took all the bids in that coastal plain, I think we came to about $500 million with all of that leasing. So if you looked at, again, but we're looking at 1.5 million acres here. That's the most that this area would cover, and I think lots of folks have been looking at what the potential for oil is. There oil there? That's all debated. But we sort of assumed yes, and looked at, again, these parcels right next door that are on state lands that are being developed or are not being developed because they're not being bid on, even though they're being offered for lease. So there's just a lot of evidence that taxpayers, no matter how you slice it, aren't going to come anywhere near $1 billion and nowhere near the $1.4 trillion that was needed to pay for the tax bill. That small amount of money in a market right now where there's a lot of oil and gas production happening, a lot on the markets, prices are low, doesn't really make sense to take on the risk associated with such a hard-to-access place, because you know, taxpayers also pay for handle the liabilities from spills and cleanups, and a lot of that money comes from the federal coffers. So it seems like a lot of risk with little reward to drill here in the Arctic now, and just a purely political move and not one that's based that makes any fiscal sense.
So what's next on this issue? What's happening now?
So this week the House is taking a vote on a bill to repeal this provision. I mean, we aren't involved in all the specifics of that legislation, but we are definitely think that the Department of Interior should take a pause and slow the brakes here before they move forward with these leasing proposals. I mean, taxpayers don't win in this current scenario.
Great. So just as a reminder, you're listening to Common Sense Conversations with Taxpayers for Common Sense. Also, our website is taxpayer.net if you want to look at any of the products that we're talking about during the conversation. And if you have any questions, please email us at president@taxpayer.net, and we will try to answer them during the course of the call.
One thing I wanted to add on that, though, is that we did, Brian, your piece in the Hill,
right,
just that ran
right
the end of last week. So if folks want to check that out as well, get into the details of the revenue provision on the Arctic and the vote coming up next week.
Great. So I want to turn it over to Steve to talk about what we can expect as we approach the end of the fiscal year on September 30th and kind of what's unresolved, what new things we expect to pop up, and, you know, what to look for.
Great. Thanks, Ryan. So at the in the spring or so, the Congress and the administration agreed to a new bipartisan budget agreement that set aside the caps set by the Budget Control Act for fiscal year 20 and fiscal year 2021. This will add hundreds of billions of dollars to the deficit in those 2 years, and it's estimated by CBO to add more than $1 trillion over 10 years because it basically resets the baseline, and CBO assumes that each year government will grow at least at the pace of inflation. So that gave the House and the Senate their top line budget numbers, but in the interim, the House had started passing bills, not really knowing exactly what the top line is. So they've got some bills done, but they may have to adjust them to make them fit back into the BBA cap level. Well, they definitely will, because their defense bill is below and their non-defense is above. But anyway, and the Senate decided that they would just not write bills until they actually knew the amount. And so they're behind the eight ball trying to churn out legislation basically during August, thinking about this Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman Shelby. The House, kind of looking at the future, has already started drafting a continuing resolution. Here, we're just at the beginning of September, not quite to the September 30th end of the fiscal year, where unless they adopt some of those 12 bills or do a continuing resolution, that parts of government or all of government would shut down. Now, with Dorian having recently happened, there's likely to be a disaster supplemental as well. And so we'll have to see exactly as the damage estimates come in what they're looking at doing in that area.
What do you think is, I mean, I just want to point a few things out. First of all, it's just always worth remembering that the obvious point of right now, the House is controlled by Democrats, the Senate is controlled by Republicans. The fact that the House passed a bunch of bills doesn't mean they're going anywhere. So as we watch things unfold over the next month, we don't expect it to be necessarily smooth sailing. How do you think the possibility of a disaster supplemental changes the kind of likelihood of a CR, how long it might be, kind of any predictions? Not that, you know, don't hold us to them, folks.
Well, I mean, some of it is as you look at who got affected by the disaster and how much that drives a disaster supplemental. And so while, you know, Puerto Rico was, and Virgin Islands were slightly affected, they were kind of more brushed, but you had bright red states like South Carolina, you had purple states like North Carolina, Georgia were affected, and so it's likely that that's going to drive the administration to push for that and to agree to this extra cash, but also that it creates a vehicle for other elements that may try to catch a ride on that. There's the flood insurance program expires at the end of the month, and then also tax extenders are always lurking out there, and that's another likely vehicle. So I think it's pretty fair to say that there will be a push to do a disaster supplemental and maybe even couple it with the CR. The one wrinkle that I will point out is on both sides of the aisle and both sides of the Capitol, there's a bit of rancor and animus about what just happened a week ago, which was redirecting $3.6 billion of military construction funds, approved military construction funds, towards building a fence on the southern border.
So I'm going to take that opportunity to turn to Wendy, although Steve jump in, because I think even before we get into the substance of that, I want to go deep nerd and like explain how, you know, what we mean. There's a bill that's been passed and they're diverting it. So Wendy, you wanna start with that?
Sure. Steve pointed out, there has been a recent action last week by the Secretary of Defense making a determination under a previously invoked emergency declaration by the President. Military construction funds that have been approved in previous fiscal years, mostly FY18 and FY19, although not all, have been offered up to be canceled and $3.6 billion be diverted to build 174 miles of fencing. There's a lot of loose talk in the press about a wall. I have tried to, over the past few months, train myself to refer to border barriers, because a lot of this is not wall, but in this case, all 174 miles is fencing, and not all of it is new fencing either, or fencing in new areas, I should say. It is new fencing. But the nerdy deep dive side of this is something called the Anti-Deficiency Act, which is a so-called principle of federal appropriations law. And I know you're all on the edge of your seats. Tell us more about the Anti-Deficiency Act. In simple language, it says that federal employees may not spend federal money in advance or in excess of a congressional appropriation. And this is the reinforcement of the constitutional mandate giving Congress the so-called power of the purse. This Congress, actually, and the previous Congress, have made clear its view that no federal funds can be spent on barriers on the southern border. And in fact, we had a government shutdown, a rather lengthy government shutdown at the end of last year and the beginning of this year on exactly that point. So in February, the President invoked an obscure section of statute as part of an emergency declaration. And that obscure section of statute allows military construction funds to be used to further the use of the armed forces. So the president in February made an emergency declaration invoking this particular statute. It's 10 U.S.C. 2808 for everyone who's following along at home. And all that's required for Section 2808 to kick in is a determination by the Secretary of Defense that the funds would be used to further the use of the armed forces. So it's sort of a self-licking ice cream cone. We're going to send troops to the border, and that requires then the use of funds to support troops at the border. So it's very tortured. The Secretary of Defense made that determination in a letter that he sent to the Hill last week. And in that letter, he laid out what he wants to spend the $3.6 billion, what he intends to spend the $3.6 billion on, which is, as we said, 174 miles of fence.
I'm going to interrupt you and back up a little bit just to, you know, when in thinking about the Anti-Deficiency Act, the Military Construction Appropriations Bill every year is very specific. It lists projects, you know, around the country and around the world, and it's not as broad as, you know, here's $1 billion for Fort Bragg, here's $1 billion for Fort Hood. It says very specific construction projects because these are projects that have been budgeted in the way that one would budget a construction project. They haven't been, you know, just made up overnight. So these are things that have been kind of made a priority and approved by Congress and, you know, in that specifically appropriated for.
Yes. Military construction is probably the closest to earmarks that Congress, I've referred to them in my own way as backdoor earmarks. They are, as you say, highly specific. When the budget request comes in from the Pentagon, it is listed by state, by military service, by location, typically a fort or a base or something, and then the name of the project, and then the dollar figure that's requested. And you can't request, or the administration can't request military construction funds until a significant portion of design has been finished on that project. And then they fill out these long forms that they present to Congress that give the justification for each project. So if you're a congressional staffer, as I was, I would take the budget request that came over from the Congress and I would flip to the section. I happen to work for a member from Arizona. I would flip to the Arizona section and then I would start looking at the bases in Arizona, the specific projects, and I would start tracking those. And that's what you do. And your boss is very, very interested in making sure that the programs that have been set forth by the Pentagon as being important, that they are funded. There are more than 120 projects that the Pentagon proposes to defer is one word that they use for it, suggesting that they're going to come back and ask for money for those programs again. And of those, as I started looking through the lists, I noticed that there were a number of schools for the children of military service members, both in the United States and overseas. And one of them is in Kentucky. Interesting, if you are one of the senators from Kentucky or the House member who represents Fort Campbell, you'll be interested in that. One in Puerto Rico, three in Germany, two in Japan, and one in the United Kingdom. So,
and as a proud graduate of Yongsan Elementary in Yongsan Base in Seoul, Korea, I take offense to that.
Well, there you go. Korea is not touched in this particular list.
Understood.
but it could be.
It could
That's
be.
Right. You're next.
We don't want to be parochial.
I do think, though, that the point about defer raises this is not a prioritization. This isn't like saying, okay, we're going to move these to the side and go with this. They're planning on, this is an extra $3.6
right.
billion dollars that's going to end up on the deficit because these projects are going to move forward at some point.
Oh yeah, there's no doubt. We decided to write about this at TCS because it's a fairly interesting turn of events. And so we went back and pulled the budget justification documents from 3-4 years ago when these requests were first made to the Congress, And that's when we discovered some very alarming language. And I've read a lot of these justification documents in my career, and usually they're pretty dry. They're written by facilities engineers, and they talk about how many square yards of concrete and, you know, wiring harnesses and exciting stuff like that. And this talks about these justification documents, for one in particular in Germany, talks about life safety violations, that if the school is not replaced — the school, by the way, was built in 1944 in Germany, so that means it was built by the Nazis during the war — and they say things like the life safety violations include not having exit lighting, not having sufficient fire suppression systems, things that actually have to do with whether or not these kids will be safe in their school.
Right. Right.
So, I'm hoping that Congress isn't simply going to allow this hijacking of these projects.
So I want to get Steve's opinion and Wendy as well. But, you know, what can Congress do in the next month in response to this? What are their options? And then when you think about the Anti-Deficiency Act, you know, it's who gets to enforce it? You know, if it says you can't do this, and, you know, what are the remedies available to Congress?
Well, that's what puts us in a very interesting space, because we really haven't been tested in this area since the Anti-Deficiency Act was enacted, which was in response to President Nixon impounding funds and dealing with those issues and not spending funds that Congress had appropriated. And so it really is going to be who has standing. Can Congress, is it the members that represent these installations, can they challenge, or is it the committees that of jurisdiction, the Appropriations Committee? You know, it's not really clear. We're in kind of untrod upon territory, right. And so it'll be interesting to see. And this isn't the only place within this administration that they've been challenging the Anti-Deficiency Act areas. I mean, you look at agriculture, for instance, they're finding money to do the hush money that they're giving to farmers to placate them because of the cost of the trade war. And so they're relying on statutes that give kind of a slush fund to the Secretary of Agriculture that date back to, speaking of World War II, basically 1944 as well, and some of the ag policies from that and from the Great Depression. And that so you see Sonny Perdue, doling out this cash, announcing it at various functions, and this is not money that's been appropriated by Congress, at least not for that purpose. And so it's really interesting to see how, if you want to step back and just be a government and policy nerd to see how this plays out, if you're worried about our institutions and our Congress and our country, well, it's a different matter.
So one other thing it's worth pointing out is as the administration kind of ignores Anti-Deficiency Act violations or potential Anti-Deficiency Act violations in areas where they're very eager to move forward, it's just worth noting that in litigation, when they've been challenged for not providing certain things, both in the context of the detention facilities at the border and in a few other areas, they have used the Anti-Deficiency Act as a defense of saying, well, we can't get that stuff because it hasn't been appropriated. So, you know, again, it's not the first administration to talk out of both sides of its mouth, but it's worth noting that in the kind of battle for power of how we control money, does Congress really want to maintain control of power of the purse, or is it going to give it up to the administration in greater and greater ways? Well, we're just going to have to wait and see.
We had an event earlier in the summer on border issues, and we had a former Republican member of the House Appropriations Committee who spoke at that event, and he was asked the question of what do you think is going to happen with we were talking about the emergency declaration.
Right.
We weren't talking about this specific set of projects because we didn't know about it yet. But we asked him, what do you think is going to happen? You know, how will this be stopped? And he said the only way it can be stopped is if Congress takes him to court. And that was his take. Now he's
right.
No longer a member of Congress, but that was his take.
Well, and we have seen Congress take the administration to court. The question is, how many times do they want to do it? And they could, I mean, Steve, you should jump in and tell me that this is incorrect rank speculation, but, you know, in the course of the next 3 weeks, you know, they can definitely put language in some bill that passes that says you can't do this, and they could still ignore it.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've clearly taken advantage of certain legislation to move this forward, you know, they're going to have to get the administration to buy off on whatever they slip into that legislation. Simply right. because they put it in there doesn't right. mean it's going to happen. And so that's why a government shutdown becomes even more realistic, is that there may be a fight over that. And what we've always seen on this is both sides trying to figure out who's going to get the blame for a government shutdown, because we know they're not popular. And so if House Democrats think that they are going to come out as a victor in that, then they'll probably push forward with it. If the Trump administration thinks they're going to come out as a victor, they'll probably push forward. You know, and so it's really unclear exactly how it will play out, but it definitely makes the possibility of a shutdown much more likely.
I think that's right. Go ahead, Wendy.
I also think it puts the majority leader of the Senate in an interesting position. Senator McConnell has one of those schools that for which the funding would be yanked to build more fencing on the border is
and
in
like
Kentucky.
It's like $68 million. Yeah, it's not a small amount.
Right. So I think you couple that with the fact that both Republican and Democratic members are having projects yanked out from under
right.
that they've been planning on and talking about for a number of years. It's a different political calculus than I think we've had in a lot of shutdowns.
I think that's right, but again, it's going to be about, you know, vote counting and what can get through.
And actually, I would say that you know, when this was first announced, I sort of thought that, you know, they would find the blue districts to target,
nope.
the blue
right.
states to target. Yep. But I will, to the administration's credit,
yep.
It is broadly scattered across the country, and it is in red states and blue states, and, you know, in red districts and blue districts. It hasn't been sort of, okay, I'm going to pick on my enemy.
It's interesting also that there was the original list that came out in March, I think, of potential projects. 5 states dropped off that list and were not affected by the list that has now been is now named the final list. And those states are Georgia, Illinois, Missouri, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. So again, there's no political pattern there to, you know, they're not swing states, they're not all swing states, they're not all early primary states. You know, there's the political calculus does not seem to show in that list.
Okay, well, we are coming to the end of a half an hour. I want to just, first of all, encourage everybody to go to the website and look at, we've got lots on the issue around the Anti-Deficiency Act violations and the projects that have been deferred. We've got lots on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge revenues and other oil and gas work that is, you know, also about not getting quite as much money as we could. And also just stay tuned this month. It's going to be a busy several weeks because they've either got to pass a CR, pass some spending bills, or decide they're going to shut down the government in the next 3 weeks. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We look forward to talking to you next month.
You've been listening to Common Sense Conversations, a production of Taxpayers for Common Sense. To find out more about us, go to www.taxpayer.net.